Accession number 7252, reel number 2.
Colonel Osborne, reel 2. Did you have any training at Sabderet with signalling?
Yes. As I think I mentioned before, we had two forms of communication. One was heliograph, which of course operated perfectly in that sort of climate with permanent sunshine and clear skies. But we had, in this training prior to Carillon, we were issued with virtually the first wireless sets that we had seen. And I don't think that we, our signalers were perhaps particularly proficient in using them, but we certainly had an awful lot of problems with them. But we did practice a great deal with that, plus, of course, telephone line. The whole business of carrying cable on mules. And laying them along defined paths, all that sort of business. In fact, the heliograph, we, as a result of the training there, we came to the conclusion it was probably going to be our best bet in the event. It was to, I'm afraid, rather let us down.
What were the problems with the wirelesses?
Oh, I think largely because in those days they were not particularly powerful or efficient. There was a great deal of interference. And I think really it was largely the fact that I don't think that people were probably practically well trained on them. It was after all, it was still in its infancy.
Was there any problem with the local iron?
There might have been. Of course, this is an aspect that I hadn't thought of, but I think it would be quite likely because, of course, there was a great deal of mineral in those mountains and hills, and I would think this is probably more than likely. In fact, I would hazard a guess that this is still probably a bad wireless area for that reason.
What happened after Sabderet?
Well, I think it was two or three days short of 3 weeks, we were suddenly summoned to a commanding officer's conference and told that we were going to embass and for the battle area, and that the first attack on Kerin position had failed or Tenerate had come to a stop, and 9 brigade was going to be put in. And so we got into our buses and we very, very soon, of course, began to hear the firing and so on. And we, as we got into the Kerin Valley, we could see on the hills outlined in the distance puffs of smoke and so on. And we bivouacked the night, I well remember, rather that at the end of the day, and the commanding officer immediately, who was a chap called Mickey Rodwell, ordered an O group to assemble a couple of miles ahead on a small promontory in the middle of the valley, which possibly was rather a foolish place. Because no sooner we got on the top, and the commanding officer was giving out the information, when the enemy started firing at us, lobbing the odd shell at us, so we had to sort of get down, and from rather crouched positions and not very good observation, he continued his O group. And we discovered that we were having to assemble in the early hours of the morning, in the valley, at the foot of one of the mountains, which was Sancho, I think. And that the battalion was the reserve battalion for the 9th Brigade attack. It was because of the terrain, because of the narrowness of it, it was going to be a leapfrog attack, in other words, one brigade after another. So we got into our positions, and we had a very uncomfortable, what was left of the night, plus the whole day, cowering behind boulders at the foot of Mount Sancho, with the enemy shells, which were supposed to be engaging the Camerons of the 4th Indian Division, who were on top of Sancho, but in fact, of course, the mountain was so precipitous that many of the shells overshot and landed amongst us, and we really got quite a few casualties as a result, and it was having quite an effect on morale. But mercifully, at about, and also the other brigades of the division were getting quite a few casualties, and these casualties were coming through us, which is always rather distressing sort of period. Anyway, at about, if I remember rightly, at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, an orderly came and summoned me up to the commanding officers and get another O group, and he then gave out his orders for the attack, the 9th Brigade, that night. And I, as far as I remember, I was again in reserve with the... That is right. I should perhaps have said this before, that we had, of course, reorganized the battalion on a 3-rifle company basis plus 1 company porters. So he only had 3 rifle companies to play with. And I was a reserve company for that night. Well, the attack didn't go as planned, and eventually I was put through onto a feature called the Pimple. My orders were to take the company to the top of the Pimple and to liaise with the Indian battalion, which I think was the Frontier Force battalion of one of the other brigades, who were there in situ. I should say that although it was a bright moonlight night, as soon as you got into the lee of the Pimple, this feature, of course, it was then absolutely complete inky blackness. So it took us a little time to clamber up, and eventually we got to almost the summit, and where I just fortunately met the commanding officer of the Frontier Force. And he said, well, who are you, and what you are, as I explained. And he said, well, what are you going to do? So I said, well, my orders are to wait here, having liaised with you, my orders are to wait here until my commanding officer gives me the order to attack further on. And just that moment, there was a counterattack on the Frontier Force, a lot of noise and shouting, to our right, and seemed to be slightly below us. And our commanding officer had still not come up. Now, at that moment, the commanding officer of the Frontier Force came back to me, and he said, look, I think this would be a marvelous time for you to carry on the attack, because the way you're going to go is well away from where they're counterattacking, and you'll be making use of that as cover. Well, this made very good sense. So I thought, well, perhaps I'd better take the... I'm here to use my initiative. So off I went. And I dropped down. We dropped down. I initially had a quick plan of campaign with my platoon commanders. At that time, I had only one platoon was commanded by an officer, and the other two were platoon sergeants. Well, one platoon sergeant, the other was a sergeant. And... Anyway, I gave them the order of march, as it were, and off we went. And again, we went in line of platoons, or leapfrog one behind the other. And I also said that we should be in file, or if necessary, single file. Well, we very quickly got into single file because the terrain was quite unbelievable. I mean, we'd had very good training and so on, as I've already mentioned, but really it didn't prepare us for what we encountered here. Of course, it wasn't helped by the fact that we were going down, as it were, the northern slopes of the Pimple into a little valley, and then going up this very steep, massive mountain, which was known as Fort Dolagrodador. And you could see it in the moonlight, and it really was just like a sort of Grimm's fairy tale castle that appeared to be, because it was only just the top which was actually silhouetted against the sky, and in brilliant moonlight all the rest was pitch black.
Was there an actual fort on the top?
Oh yes. It was. It was a complete rampart all the way around. Of course, I hadn't then really appreciated that it was about a 5,000-foot mountain there, and we had something like 3,000 feet to climb, which at night is really quite a distance. Anyway, off we went, and we climbed steadily. Having dropped down, we then started climbing, and the first problem I had was suddenly up at the line came a message to me saying that the anti-tank rifle men flaked out. I took a quick decision there, and I thought to myself, well, in no way can tanks possibly get anywhere near here, so I turned to dump them. I subsequently got admonished by my commanding officer for so doing, but in fact it was the only thing to do because I did realize that we would want as many men as possible at the summit. We then continued, and I suppose at about 4:30, 4:45, there was the first glimmers of dawn. And I had just passed down the line that we would halt for about 5 minutes to get our breath, because by then we were really clambering up on all fours. When suddenly I noticed to our left, and only about, I suppose it couldn't be more than 300 yards away, I thought I saw a movement, and I thought for a moment it might be an animal. And then anyway, I had my company sergeant major with me, and I said, "Now look," he confirmed. He said, "No, I think that could be the enemy." So we just stayed where we were for the time being, and then as it got lighter, we suddenly realised that it was an Italian machine gun nest, with its machine guns pointing not at us, but down the hill, or at least almost in the opposite direction. So I quietly passed down the line a message for the 2-inch mortar team to come up, and which they did with their little 2-inch mortar, which of course we had practiced a great deal during training, and what a first-class little weapon it is, or was rather. And I pointed out the target. Well, it didn't necessitate me that they could see it, but the trouble was, of course, there was no opportunity really to range. I mean, normally with a mortar, what you do is you first of all deliberately exaggerate the range, so if you bracket, in other words, you pop one beyond, one perhaps four short, and then in the middle one is the one. Well, of course, obviously one couldn't do that, because if we did that, it would alert them. So I said, "Now, look, you've got to get this right. It's got to be absolutely a dead hit the first round." Well, of course, this was one of the things which sometimes happens in war. We were in luck, and their first round absolutely hit its mac on. And it silenced, it killed all the crew, and silenced that. And so on we went. Now, I was slightly worried, of course, by then, because I realized that my commanding officer would be in some, if I was probably not, maybe rather annoyed, but certainly he would be in a dilemma. Because part of the plan was for my assault of Fort Dorogorodok to be supported by a battery of artillery or more. And this was not only going to be a 12-pounder, but it was going to be a 6-inch howitzer. And which packed quite a punch. And it was, the plan was that they were going to bring down, with our yellow screens, they would be able to see us. In addition, I, of course, had a signal section with me with heliographs, and we would flash back. They'd be able to gauge our position. They would then bring down a barrage, first of all, on the fort itself, and then immediately behind it, to cut off those retreating enemy. But that was the plan. But of course, me having started off early, plus the fact that what I didn't realise, and in fact nobody realised, was that neither could they see our screens, nor could they pick up our helio message. And so they decided that for safety reasons, they would bring forward their barrage in timing, so there was no possibility of our for getting in the way. Well, it so happened that unfortunately the first barrage fell short of the fort by about a couple of hundred yards, and so in fact amongst us. And again, I had to take a quick decision, and I mean, it's either a question of running down the hill again, we certainly couldn't stay where we were, or simply advancing. And we chose the latter. And of course, this, in fact, is really what was responsible for the taking of the fort, because the Italians had their heads down because of the barrage, thinking that any moment it was going to lift onto them. And we were at the ramparts by the time they realised what had happened. And at that moment, an absolute shower of these wretched red grenades were literally hurled at us. And having, as I say, been rather sort of scathing about them, we then realised what lethal things they were. Well, they were not lethal. I mean, they never killed you. But what they could do, of course, was to blow a toe off or a hand or something like that. And we did get some nasty injuries that way. But we were on top of them, and there was very little they could do. And so we jumped into the ramparts, and as the rest of the enemy scampered off down the hill at the rear of the fort. Of course, we did receive quite a few casualties. In fact, some really very heavy casualties. I think I entered that operation with, I really can't remember now, but I suspect it was something like about 90 men. And by the time we finished, we were down to about 30. So we did receive some quite heavy casualties. The question, of course, was we also captured, I suppose, must have been about 20 odd Italians, including an officer who turned out to be the equivalent of the field cashier. And he had, I mean, the actual commander of there was in fact a company in this, as we discovered afterwards, had got away. But I don't know whether he'd been asleep or something, but anyway, he was there, and it turned out that he had come out to pay out the troops the evening before and had got caught there. I might add his money was, if I might transgress for a moment, the money there, of course, was quite useful because it was all in Italian lira, and there was boxes and boxes of it. And of course, after a bit, we required paper for various purposes, and so very generously, I used to dish out this. Well, my sergeant major used to dish out these there are notes, little realizing that in fact they were still legal currency. And when we got into Asmara subsequently, many of the soldiers who had been much more sensible than me had kept these lira notes, and they spent them in the shops. Anyway, we got up there, and the light, of course, was then by broad daylight. We realized that we had been lucky in getting there, and it didn't require a genius to realize also that we were going to be hard put to stay there, because almost immediately the Italians put in a counterattack, which we managed to repel. By then, I had got into communication with the battalion headquarters by what radio, not by helio. You see, the trouble was that it was so steep that you got the sort of overhang, as it were, so that really the flashing light just couldn't be seen. And it was... And we were there as a company. We did, in fact, we got, sometime during the morning, a second company, I think it was B Company, came up to join us. And A and B Companies were in that fort for a week. We were cut off on two occasions by Italian counterattacks. We began to get short of rations. The Rhodesian squadron, air squadron, very gallantly tried to drop supplies to us, but they all fell down the hill, and the only people who got them were the Italians. But we managed to survive. The worst problem, of course, was not food so much, was water, which was quite a problem. And although it was high, the heat, of course, was appalling in the day, and with a lot of bodies lying around, which we couldn't bury, because it was complete hard rock. So the only thing we could do really was to chuck them over the edge on the Italian side and hope for the best. But of course, it didn't roll the hill, down the hill very far, and so the stench and so on was appalling. And this had rather obviously had a certain effect on morale. It was highly unpleasant.
Can you describe the layout of the fort?
Yes, it was. When I say it was a fort, it had originally been a fort. It had fallen into considerable disrepair, but the actual ramparts were still in existence. In other words, there was a ditch running right the way round the fort, which I suppose was about in depth was about 6 foot, and perhaps 3 feet across. And every so often there were little bays, which obviously you could use for protection yourself, or for storing ammunition or whatever. And in the middle, there were two or three strong rooms, really. I suppose what it was it was originally presumably built by the Italians at the time when they were pacifying the country and taking it over. You see, it did, in fact, of course, command the whole countryside. I mean, it was the kernel of the, with a K, of the whole position. And in fact, years later, I remember discussing it with an Italian officer. And the battle of the Keren position was not only considered impregnable by them, but it formed the backcloth for their main defensive exercise at their staff college. And Fort Dolagorodok was considered to be the absolute key. So we were very lucky to get it. I mean, I think that it was, as I've tried to explain, it was luck was on our side. But I think if luck had not been on our side, I think we should have taken a great deal longer to capture it. And I think we should have gotten many, many more casualties.
Can you describe the Italian counterattacks in a bit more detail?
Yes. Well, I told you, within about half an hour, I suppose it was probably an hour, of our getting in, I suppose, again, it was probably in about two companies. It's hard to tell, of course, strength. But they came up from the valley to our right, in that case, But they were pretty half-hearted about it. They did have a barrage of some form, which was mostly mortars, which is unpleasant. But it was certainly not unpleasant enough to dislodge us. And all we did, of course, was to cower in the trench, and then I knew damn well that you could almost time it, you know. You could say, well, within 10 minutes, they'll be within rifle distance, which of course it was, and so we just then, rather like sort of the prisoner of Zenda or something, we just sort of popped over the parapet, aimed a shot or two at them, and off they went.
Did the Italian captives tell you anything?
No. Well, I, of course, wanted to get rid of them, so I sent them down the hill under escort straight away. But there was one little anecdote which perhaps might be of interest. The officer, who turned out to be quite a good French speaker, and I can speak French, and he who told me that, of course, if he really was in the equivalent of the Italian Army Pay Corps, virtually a non-combatant, and that he'd been up there just to pay the soldiers out. And he, as he was being led away, he suddenly sort of shouted back to me something in French. So I told the soldier to bring him back to me, and he said, proffering his gold Longines watch, would I take this? So I said, no, I don't do that sort of thing. He said, it'll only be taken off me when I get to the little prisoner of war camp. Well, of course, there was a good deal of logic in that. But he said, in return, would I get a message to his wife, who was living in Asmara? Well, he said, you will surely be in Asmara in a few days or a week's time. So I thought, well, that's the least I can do. So I said, yes, of course I will. And I said, what's more, I will give her the watch. And tell her that when I last saw you, you were perfectly all right. And this I did. And she turned out to be an extremely nice lady. When he got there, so a few weeks later. That gives you an example, a little bit, I think, of the sort of attitude one had to the Italians. I mean, one really couldn't take them awfully seriously. One had a completely different attitude to the Germans, I regret to say, and indeed the Japanese. But the Italians were, I think, rather special. And we realised that the officers were really pretty inefficient, but certainly the native troops fought very well indeed.
Did they seem pleased or displeased to be captured?
You know, I think in a way rather almost pleased. I think almost relieved. Yes. I think a fair comment.
What happened next?
Well, after a week, as far as I was concerned, I was withdrawn from the fort, and then almost immediately the final battle of Keren took place, when both divisions, 4th and 5th, on a two-divisional front, which in fact was on a two-brigade front, simply swept on beyond Fort Dolagoradoc and aimed at Asmara. And the next time that we were in action was at a place called Ad Teclisum, which was about halfway between Keren and was really virtually the next town, only town, between Keren and Asmara, the capital. We didn't have too much information about it, but we guessed that probably the opposition wouldn't be too heavy. And again, I found myself leading the assault in this particular one, even though I was badly depleted in numbers. And this was, for me, it was a very sad occasion. It should have been a very happy one, because in fact this is what happened, was what we had forecasted. As soon as we started advancing, they all started to wave white flags and give themselves up, and we captured an enormous number. I mean, I think it went into the hundreds. But unfortunately, there was a lone sniper, and my.